All right, we'll begin our journey today. And you know, before you go on adventures with Indiana Jones, he'd often have to do the research first. He'd hang up the hat and he'd be Professor Jones and look at all the facts to lead him to where they needed to go. If you're an Indiana Jones fan, I'll say a quick survey. How many people of all the movies would say Raiders is your favorite Indiana Jones movie? Any Raiders fans? All right. Yeah, some of us. How many Temple Doom? There's always one in each crowd. Yeah, okay. The coal scene, pretty amazing. Last Crusade?
315, we called the dog Indiana.
Yeah.
You chose poorly.
How about Dial of Destiny, the recent one? Am I the only one who saw that? A couple people. Okay, how about Crystal Skull, the alien one? Yeah, no hands for that one. I think these movies have just captured our attention because it made archaeology interesting, adventure, the bullwhip and the hat and everything else that came along with him. And today as we look at Mom Ray, I want to suggest to you that Mom Ray is like a five-layer cake. And those five different layers that the archaeologists looked at, they invite us to take a bite out of history. And so today, as you're exploring faith or looking to substantiate your faith or just wondering what's really true of all the religions, I want to give you three tastes today. A taste of something that's not just wishful thinking, but a taste of something that might be true. Secondly, a taste of a promise that you could hold on to even over time. Maybe even a taste of joy. I had lunch recently with a friend, just getting to know him. We met for about 90 minutes. He was a pastor who's now an agnostic. And as we dialogued over at lunch, he said, yeah, my biggest concern is the Bible. He said, I don't think the Bible's been a source for good. He kind of laid out his case of how it oppressed women and how it endorsed slavery. And I don't think the Bible is good. I don't think the Bible's true. I think people made it up. And I think that there's no evidence to support it. And so we just had this fascinating dialogue. And as many of you know, I will often bring friends of different perspectives on stage and let them put me in the hot seat for 40 minutes. We haven't quite built our friendship up to that point. But I might bring them in the next couple years and just have that dialogue here in front of you. Because I think it's so helpful to say, is belief in Christianity, belief in the Bible, just wishful thinking? I believe it because I grew up in it or my parents believed it. Are there actually facts to back it up? What if you could have a faith rooted in facts? Wouldn't that be different? Wouldn't it be different to not just wish something's true, but to know it's true? Let me tell you a little story of what happened here at Mom Ray and why this is such an important site. It begins by giving us a taste of something true. A taste of something true. So on the map, where is Hebron and where is Mom Ray? So if you look at the Mediterranean Sea, you see this little cross section here of where Israel is, and right where that tree is where we're going to find Mom Ray. Now we've got to go back in time to 2000 BC, and just off the map, over in this section over here is where Abraham, also known as Abram, lived. And God appears to him and says, I want to make you a promise. And God says, I will give you a land. I will give you descendants, because he and his wife are currently barren. And I will give you a descendant that will be the final forgiver and fixer of the world. Now, the first thing we learn about Abraham is that he disobeys God. We find out that Abraham, though he put some trust in God, he almost does everything else wrong. God says, don't bring Lot, your nephew, with you, any family members with you. He brings his family members with him. We find out Abram's pretty insecure. He must have a really good-looking wife because he's so insecure about his good-looking wife. He's always lying and saying she's a sister. Well, the local Pharaoh decides he kind of wants to date his wife and finds out later she's already married and gets mad and kind of kicks him out of Egypt. Then he does it again a few years later, different Pharaoh. Picks up a second wife, contrast to what God says. And it's all in the middle of all of that that problems begin to pile up because Abram really is an insecure, disobedient father of the faith of Judaism and Christianity. What a weird story. Well, that warning he gave about not following or taking his nephew Lot with him comes to a culmination in Genesis chapter 13. It says, Abraham becomes very, very wealthy and rich with livestock. Lot also, that's his nephew he wasn't supposed to bring with, had lots of flocks and herds, and the land just could not support the massive companies the two of them had together, infighting amongst servants, things like that. So Abram, in a very gracious way, turns to Lot and says, let's not have strife between us. Let's divide the land in half. You pick, and I'll let you go first. And one portion of the land was a little bit better than the other portion. And of course, Lot picks the better portion. But Abraham says, I'd rather take the less nice piece in order to not have so much angst and anger amongst us. Now, growing up as a kid, I had heard this story. As a person who grew up in a Christian family, I believed in Jesus, I believed in the Bible, and I believed in God. But then as a student, I began to study the archaeological evidence, the background, the details, and I went from just believing something to substantiating something with the external facts. And that made my belief a little bit deeper. But my wife and I got a chance to go to Israel many years ago, and that's the two of us. We hiked for hours to get to this location. We finally get to this location, sitting on that rock, and because of the things mentioned in the manuscript of Genesis, certain cities you can see from one location, this place where Abram and Lot divide up the land is in this exact location. And I went from knowing it and believing it to experiencing it. To be there in this moment and say, this is the moment that all the major religions of the world began because God appeared to Abraham. You could just feel it, not just think it and believe it. Well, right after this moment, where Abraham's kind of cleaning up the mess he made, God is going to appear to him and give him a promise. So if you remember in our five-layer cake, we're down here at 2000 BC at the Middle Bronze Age is what we find there at Mamre. And there's a promise God makes in the manuscripts. He says, the Lord turns to Abram, says, lift up your eyes now and look from the place where you're at, right here where you and Lot had this conversation, for all the land that you can see I'm going to give to you. Then Abraham, after having that conversation, moved his tent and went and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre. And in the Bible, the word oaks and terebinth get used interchangeably. It's kind of a word for big tree. Keep that in mind. So they go to the oaks of Mamre, which are near a city called Hebron. And he immediately says, I want to mark the moment that God appeared to me, and he built an altar there. Well, as I said, he promised they would have kids. They don't have any. He promised they'd have a land. They don't have one. And he promised they'd one day have a descendant that would be a forgiver for the world. Well, they wait for weeks. No child. They wait for months. No child. They wait for years. No child. They wait for decades. No child. Is this really true? Is it really true if it's not happening? We pick up the story 25 years later. She's 99. He's 100 years old. Or maybe 1 year prior. She's 98 and he's 99. This can't be true. It hasn't happened yet. And God reappears to them at this location and reaffirms it is true. Then the Lord appeared to him at the oaks of Mamre again 25 years later as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day and says, sure enough, just because it took longer than you thought, just because it didn't happen the way you thought, it's still true and it's going to happen. You're going to have a child. A child? I'm 100 years old. Trust me, I can do it. Now, to kind of picture what this might have looked like, picture Abraham and all of his family gather around in tents. He's built an altar right in the middle from 25 years earlier. God made a promise of something true. These gigantic oak trees are right there, and this is what it would look like at 2000 BC. Now, the archaeologist, his name is Andreas Mader, in the 1900s, 1920s, he begins to go to seminary. And he loves reading the Bible and reading it as manuscript and reading it as historical data points. But he really wants to go dig in the rocks because he's noticing all these digs that they've been doing with Roman ruins and how people are excited about the Roman Empire and the evidence for the Roman Empire. So he's like, wouldn't it be great to put a spade in the ground and find out if the things the Bible claims are true really are true? His fellow seminarians are like, nah, just read the Bible and just have faith. He's like, I do have faith, but I want to get into the soil like they've done in the Roman ruins and see what I can find. So he heads over and uses the Bible as a treasure map to find all the different clues and locations, and he gets to the spot we now know as Mamre. Just as he begins to dig and set up the dig, World War I kicks out, and he gets drafted. He becomes a chaplain. And during his time in World War I, serving as a chaplain, a grenade goes off, putting shrapnel into his leg. He's going to walk for a limp for the rest of his life. After World War I is over, he gets back to his passion. He wants to get back to Israel. All the sketches, all the clues, all the facts, they make their way back, and for 2 years they dig there. Hot, blistering sun, but every layer he begins to unpack, he's getting more and more excited that it is validating everything he saw and believed and read about for his entire life. He gets done with these digs, finding all these different artifacts. And here's what he writes in his book in 1957. He says, "Excavations reveal a sacred space, preserved through centuries tied to Abraham's divine encounter, reflecting unbroken reverence for its holy past through time, linking it to the Genesis narrative." He's saying, I didn't just believe it was true. I don't just know it's true. I've experienced it to be true. What if the Bible's not just bedtime stories and Aesop's fables? What if it's a true blueprint for your life? As I was preparing this series 4 or 5 months ago, I got a buddy who's not really a churchgoer, and he said, "Hey, what are you working on?" I said, "I'm working on this Indiana Jones thing," and I talked about the artifacts and archaeology. He's like, "Well, wait a second. You're saying the Bible is history?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "It doesn't claim primarily to be religion, shockingly. It doesn't even claim primarily to be philosophy. It claims primarily to be history. You can't really double-check philosophy in the dirt. You can't double-check religion in the dirt, but you can double-check history in the dirt." I said, "I didn't know that. You mean there's evidence for the things laid out?" I said, "Yeah. It's something that's true." So what happens here at Mamre? Well, it's not just a taste of something true, it's also the taste of a promise. God makes a promise here to mankind, a promise not only for them, but it applies to those who would come later. We're here today discovering something because of what happened at 2000 BC. So what is it? Well, Abram looks up one day, and it says, "The Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees," like I said, those are interchangeable terms for big trees, "of Mamre." So it says the God of the universe appears to a guy named Abram. Yet when he looks up to see the Lord, it says he lifted his eyes up and he looked and he saw three men were standing by him. It didn't look like God, didn't look like a big glowy star or anything. He appeared in the form of a human being. As the story unpacks, we find out there are two angels that look like human beings and God in the middle. To which you're like, "Chad, this is why I can't take the Bible seriously. You tell me that God appears as man. How convenient. He looked like a man." What I always say is, if God is all-powerful, then God can do anything. Yet if God wants to be approachable, he would put himself in the form of something we know. And this becomes pretty shocking, honestly, compared to other religions, that the God of the Bible would appear in the form of a human being in order to relate to us so we can understand him and see him. And this becomes a little hint at the story of Jesus, that God decides to appear in the form of a man so that we could experience him, we could understand him, the God who is invisible could suddenly be visible so we could really realize what he was like. So, God appears to him, but it looks like three men, two angels and God in the middle, and they were standing by him. Abram runs to meet with them and say, "Who are you?" Doesn't know it's God yet. That'll come later in the text. And he begins to dialogue with them and provide for them and give a meal for them and then bake a big loaf of bread for them. And again, when they dug down to that layer, that's exactly what they found. They found this altar marked there in orange right in the middle on this top layer. If you look in the middle on the right, you'll see the circular top. That's the Byzantine chapel from the 350 AD level. Very specific architecture which matched the olive pits they checked out and the pottery they checked out. But there was an altar there that dated to 2000 BC, just like this records. And when they began to examine the rocks, they found all kinds of evidence. Here in the top right, you'll see the well. A well is marked there from the Herodian layer. You see that big circle where the trees used to be, exactly as was indicated and then marked in the Herodian layer around 100 AD to 100 BC. But if you move up to the Herodian layer, you get a little bit more evidence to what happens here. What is the promise that was made here? And why do so many people mark this moment for that promise over time? Well, here's what happens. God says, I'm going to make you a great nation. Remember, that's 25 years ago. You currently own no land. I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to bless you. He's already had some of that with all the flocks and all the livestock and a successful business. You're also going to have descendants. It's like, I don't have any descendants. And in you, all the families of all the earth are going to be blessed. Because your great, 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 great grandson is going to come and forgive the world. Well, it's been 25 years, no descendants. This is not a great promise. This doesn't feel like it's working. So God comes back to him here at this moment, after 25 years of waiting, and he says to Abraham, he's changed his name by now, you're going to have a child. And his 99-year-old wife bursts out laughing. What are you talking about? Me having a baby? I'm going to be the only mother going to get diapers and depend undergarments at the same time. She laughs. It's ludicrous. This is a ludicrous promise. It's ridiculous that this would happen. And God says, why did Sarah laugh? Saying, surely I'm too old to bear a child since I'm old. And God's going to say, my promises can transcend your own weaknesses. I can still do it. So again, if you're a German archaeologist and you're digging down, all right, you're picturing that the Herodian layer in its day would have looked something like that. We got the altar in the middle. We got that well marked in the corner. These gigantic walls are placed up there because Herod did everything big. But they didn't find something that looked like this. They found something that had holes in it, paver stones. Which means at that time, those two trees, the same trees that had been there, because they lived for thousands of years, from the time of Abraham, were still there marking this place on the site plan. That God made a promise that there would one day be a Jewish people who would have a land there in the Middle East near the Dead Sea. They'd have lots and lots of descendants, and one of their descendants would come and give his life for the world. So did that really happen? We're at 2025, we can see the evidence of whether or not that promise really came true. I'll give you an example of this. There's a king, King Louis XIV. He brought Blaise Pascal. He was a philosopher and a mathematician, more of a philosopher than anything. But he was a professor at the college. And he was a man of faith who believed in God and believed in Jesus and thought the evidence supported the Bible's claims. So King Louis said to him one day, give me just one proof that God exists. Just one. Blaise Pascal writes this in his book called Pensées. He says, I will summarize the best proof for God in one word. This will be good, right? One word. King's like, what one word? He says, Jews. The Jewish people. God made a promise this guy never heard of named Abraham would have hundreds and thousands of descendants. There's millions of them. Number two, there's been no country in the world that has been so eradicated and so tortured and so chased out, taken from their land by the Assyrians, by the Babylonians, by the Romans. And yet, a remnant always remains. And they've actually been returned to their land. How many groups of people in history were ripped out of their land, attempted to be annihilated, and then came back to that land again and again and again? Blaise Pascal says, the Jews. The evidence of the descendants of the land and of the promise God made. I was in a small group years ago here at Horizon, and we were meeting down in Marymount at a friend of mine's house, and he was asking me questions about the Bible, just bombarding me with different questions, and I was answering this, and check out this, and have you heard about that? And he worked pretty high up in P&G, and as he was listening to me for a while, he's like, Chad, are you telling me that God has claim support? Like, well, I don't use that term. What does that mean? He goes, well, when we make a claim in P&G about a product, what it does, what it doesn't do, we have to have the documentation or the receipts to show that our claim is supported by the evidence. I've never heard this before. You're showing me that there's actually claim support for what the Bible says. That's why I guess I am. And if the little things are true, the big things can be true as well. That God came to earth to forgive us of all our wrongdoing. And so we were talking that night about the fact that if God forgave us everything we've done wrong, and if Jesus is that great, 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 great descendant of Abraham, and if he was willing to forgive us everything we've done, could we forgive our enemies? I'll never forget this day. We all went into his backyard. He lives on the Little Miami River, and we reached down and we picked out a rock, each one of us. We picked something someone had done to us that was just stuck in your craw. All right, some gossip, some stab in the back, and I knew exactly what mine was. And we took that rock. We all walked over together to Little Miami, and we said, we're going to throw this rock in the water, and we're going to say, since God forgave me what I've done wrong, I'm going to forgive what this person did wrong. So that bitterness and unforgiveness doesn't haunt me. And I remember throwing that rock into Little Miami. Kung, kung, kung. It was about 18 years ago. I figure by now it's gone down the Little Miami, down the Ohio. Maybe it's made to New Orleans. But I tell you, I will mark that moment that I have not been in bitterness since. The claim support of God coming to forgive me and a promise made 2000 BC motivated me and other friends to find forgiveness in our life as well. It's something true, it's a promise, but it's also a taste of joy. Let me tell you what this taste of joy, because the story unfolds a year later because God shows up, and sure enough, as he predicted, at 99 and 100, they're going to have a child. And yet when she first heard it, she laughs, but it's a particular type of laugh. Let me show you what she does. Now, he said, I will certainly return to you, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Not your second wife, not your backup plan, my plan. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old. Thank you very much. No, they were old, old. The Bible, the manuscripts want you to know they were old. Okay, we got it, we got it. So Sarah, hearing this promise 9 months before she delivers, she laughed to herself, saying, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also. And the Hebrew word for laughed here is a word for a cynical laugh. Right, that's going to happen. Yeah, I'll believe that when I see it. It's that kind of cynical laughter. It's kind of the mood of our culture today is just cynicism toward everything. But this certainly had a lot of reason to be cynical, right? But look at where her cynicism comes from. It comes from a lot of pain. She says, after I have grown old, man, I gave up on that 10 years ago. Please, don't bring that dream back up. I finally come to peace. It's not going to happen. It's very old. I've waited a long time. I don't know if I want to reawaken that part of my heart. After I've grown old and I'm not capable of doing it anymore. And then even she marks in here, shall I have pleasure? Seems to indicate the two of them have not been intimate in a long time. Their relationship's not everything they want it to be. Maybe she mentions too, my Lord is old also at age 100. Maybe he's not able to give her pleasure, not able to be intimate with her. And so that's where her cynical laughter comes from. It's understandable. There's just a lot of pain going on. And for many of us, when we experience pain or something takes longer than we thought, or we wonder if something's true, we just have that cynical laugh that comes from a place of pain. Yet God is going to take that cynical joy, that painful joy, and transform it. Now, 350 BC, you see up here at the top this Byzantine church. It's a circle, almost like a Roman arch would be, but this is embedded into the top-down view of the Byzantine church. Christians who now had recognized Jesus had come to bring forgiveness, and even at the cross, when he'd been crucified, a time of incredible despair, that cross became a symbol of joy and renewal and beginnings and resurrection. They marked this place not as a place of death or a place of pain or a place of cynicism, but as a place of joy. Why? It didn't look very joyful so far. Well, let me show you what that church may have looked like in its day. Massive Byzantine church, 350 BC, marking that altar, Still got the well. Because it says that a year after this conversation, the Lord appeared just as he had said. Just as he said. Sarah conceived 98-99. She bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time. Not their time, but at the set time which God had told them a year earlier. And Abraham called him, this child, whom Sarah bore, Isaac. To which you're like, all right, what's the big deal? In Hebrew, the word Isaac means laughter. But now we've moved from cynical, painful laughter to unbelievable, I never thought this could happen to me laughter. The kind of joy that says, even when I go through hardship and difficulty, there can be something sweet on the other side. I was at the Reds game this week, and I know we're praying for a victory tonight. And we're at the Reds game, and a buddy of mine who's just started reading the Bible, never read the Bible before, he's sitting next to me. We didn't even watch most of the game because he wanted to talk about Genesis of all things. He's like, I started reading the Bible. I didn't realize how hilarious the Bible was. I said, tell me, what have you found funny? He goes, that story of Sarah. God shows up and is like, you're going to have a baby. And she's like, bah! And then she has one. And she names him Laughter. That is unbelievable. He never read the story before. Maybe you haven't either. Can you feel the cultural mood we live in that's just filled with such cynicism and cynical laughter and there's no hope. Don't believe in anything so you don't let your hopes down. Well, I think Sarah's laughter is the cultural mood we live in today. But what if there could be a joy that no matter what I go through, I know good will come out of it. No matter what's done to me, I know I can forgive them and I'm going to live in peace. There is a type of joy available to all of us that you can find at Mom Ray. Mom Ray is a 5-layer cake inviting us to take a bite out of history. A taste of something true, a taste of a promise you can hold on to, that the forgiveness we talk about as a church is because of that promise made to Abraham at that location. It's also a taste of real joy. So maybe in this series you want to do something you've never done before. You want to dig into a faith that might be rooted in facts. Maybe it's not just that people's belief system comes from their parents, their culture, where they grew up. Maybe it can come from investigation of the facts. What if, in all the different answers to all the different questions, who is God, what happens when you die, what's truth, what's the problem in life, what's the solution, what if you could actually get answers? And if so, why not start digging into it now? So for 6 weeks, we're going to be exploring it here on Sundays. But if you want to go deeper, let me give you a couple resources. One is a book called When God Came Down. This is written by an archaeologist by the name of Joel Kramer. And it's got photographs, it's got graphics, it's got writings of all kinds of evidence of the Bible in archaeological form. It's a very fun read, very visual. If you don't like reading a lot, the pictures are amazing. If you don't really like books, you're more of a podcast guy or YouTube person, he's got a YouTube channel called Expedition Bible. He goes on location, they're all about 20 to 30 minutes, and they show you evidence for claims the Bible makes and what the archaeologists have found. A chance to dig down into your faith. You might say, well, I don't have a faith. Well, dig down and find the answers to the questions you have. Exploration Bible, where God came down. Or honestly, that's why we as a church do what we do. We are yours to explore. We want to help you wherever you're on your journey, take the next step. Do you remember that scene from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade? You know, we'll invite the band to come out this next song while I tell you the story. You probably remember that scene where he stands up on that ledge, right? And he's standing up on the ledge. It says you got to take a leap of faith. You remember that scene? Camera over here. The foot goes up. Leap of faith. And there's like nothing between him and that cavern 10 feet away. And all of a sudden, he closes his eyes and is like, oh, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to take the leap of faith. And he lands on a beam that just was the same color and the same texture, and he couldn't see it until he stepped out. Remember that? And I think for many of us, the analogy of faith is, I guess I'm not going to figure out what it is. I got to step off a cliff. And you're thinking, that doesn't sound like very smart to step off a cliff. I don't think I'm going to step off a cliff. But you know what else you could do if you're Indiana Jones? You could stand on the edge, close your eyes, and go, I'm just going to fall off the cliff. Or, like he did a few minutes later, you could get down on your knees, grab a bunch of gravel, throw it out, and it will make that bridge appear. You're still going to have to step, but now you're not stepping out into a cavern that's no one's been tested. You check it out. Wow, there's a bridge there. You could even go, it might hold my weight. You could take somebody you don't like. You go first. It's going to require action. You've got to take a step, but it doesn't require blind faith. You can check out the facts and then say, I'm now going to put my confidence, my belief, my faith in the facts or what is true. As you'll hear in this next song, a journey of faith is not just a chance to dig into the facts of history, into the philosophical big questions in life. It's also a great opportunity to dig into yourself. How did I get the beliefs I had? How did I get the disbeliefs I have? How can I interrogate my skepticism? How can I interrogate what I think I believe? Can I substantiate what I believe? Have I experienced what I think I believe? As you hear this next song, take it as a challenge to ask yourself, what do I believe? Is it time to dig down into my faith and see if it's rooted in facts? Well, we want to help you in your journey. And so if we can be a help with that, whether it's joining a group or chatting with somebody, opening the Bible and just see what those claims are, what those clues are, or maybe just today, we'd love to put a name with a face. The third door on your left is going to be the hearth room. We'd love to just say hi. Any way we can help you in your journey, we want to do that. Thanks for being here today. We're going to fast forward in time to Jesus' time, 30 AD next week, and look at where was his ministry center? Is there any evidence for it, or is there any evidence for any of his disciples? And we're going to find some shocking discoveries. Thanks for being here. See you next week.